Good morning, and welcome to today's Airport Interiors What You Need to Know webinar. My name is Paul Bowers, publisher of Airport Improvement Magazine. Thank you for making this webinar a part of your day's schedule. We've hit on a really hot topic for today's webinar. We have a large audience of airport industry people on this broadcast, and why not? Airports are busier than ever, processing more passengers every year. Airport construction is running at a torrid pace. Passenger experience and optimization are a natural topic. This is something we have covered a few times in Airport Improvement Magazine. Before we get started, I would like to address a few housekeeping items to maximize the information you receive and take-home value of this webinar. Your telephones are used strictly for listening. Please mute them to minimize background noise so that you can better hear what our speakers are saying. However, you can still communicate with our presenters. Anyone wishing to make a comment or ask a question of our presenters may do so at any time through the chat feature in the lower left-hand corner of your screen. It works just like texting. Simply type in your comment or question and hit send. Your message will be sent to us. Questions are encouraged. We will save all questions sent throughout the webinar and answer as many of them as possible after our presenters have gone through their material. We have a lot of material to cover in today's webinar. We'll do our best to keep this to an hour. Some of the information may be a bit technical. Trying to write everything down during the webinar may be a challenge. Please don't feel that you need to write it all down. You may miss some good points on the next slide if you're busy writing what you just saw. For those who have missed the webinar, or any of you who would like to see the slides again, we have you covered. A recording of the webinar will be available on airportimprovement.com starting tomorrow. You can find today's webinar under the webinar tab on the homepage of the magazine site. On to the webinar. Our speakers are Matt Duby, National Market Leader, Aviation Architecture for Mead & Hunt. Matt has more than 30 years of planning, sustainability, design, and construction administration experience focused on performance-driven building solutions within the aviation industry. Matt holds a BA in Architecture from Virginia Tech and an MA in Architecture from the University of Washington. In addition, he completed the Certificate Program in Preservation, Planning, and Design from the University of Washington. He has led award-winning projects throughout the U.S. that are recognized for their regional and environmental excellence. Matt has been selected for speaking engagements by various industry groups, including the FAA, ACC, DOT, and AAAE, to discuss global trends in aviation and sustainability. Our other speaker is Joe Agathy, Director of Design, Agathy Furniture. Joe is formally trained in industrial design. He started his career with Radio Flyer, a project managing their product development department. It was here that he realized his fascination with analyzing human behavior. By observing what he calls key user insights, he was able to turn them into products that positively impact people's lives. In 2012, he joined Agathy Furniture, the family business his father started in 1981 as director of design. Agathy Furniture has a history of innovators in public space furniture industry. This stems from user behavior observation and the company's ability to transform those observations into innovative products. In the past 4 years, Joe has led Agathy's product development with new innovative products like the Pod, Pod Duo, and Power Bar, all of which result directly from observing people's behavior in public spaces and identifying ways to improve their experience. Joe, will you start us off, please?
Sure. Thanks for the introduction, Paul, and thanks everybody for attending the webinar here. Like Paul said, we'll try to keep this to an hour. We'll leave obviously time at the end for questions. So that being said, we'll get started. As you all know, airports today are not what they were 15, 20 years ago. The time of an airport just being this stopping point before you get on a flight is long gone. You know, you don't see in-service dining anymore. I vaguely remember the days that it was rude not to go meet somebody at the gate. I mean, that has long gone. It's been long gone as well. So the airports of today are changing. Hence why I have a job and why we keep coming out with new products. So they're changing for a number of reasons. You're seeing increased air travel, which leads to longer security lines, which then in turn means people are arriving earlier and earlier. And it's creating new challenges, exacerbating maybe underlying problems that we've never encountered before. But what this drives into is dwell time. people are spending more and more time at the airports. So, like I said earlier, airports aren't just this place to lounge. They're, you know, these negative behaviors, these bad behaviors that were kind of maybe a little bit of a nuisance are becoming worse and worse. Because people are spending more time there, you're going to have to find ways to create more privacy, create different type of environments for people to sit, work in, potentially eat in, and there's a greater demand for power. And it's even challenging because when people were building infrastructures 10, 15 years ago, it wasn't even thought of that someone would be carrying 2 to 3 devices with them at all times that needed to have power access. Matt, do you want to add anything on to that before I kind of move into the next section?
No, I just think that it's truly become the 21st century mobile office, and we in the industry just need to understand and cater to that.
Definitely. I think I've been sifting through airports stats over the last few weeks, and I think 40% of travelers or business travelers going through the airports these days. So it's definitely speaking to the mobile office that we kind of need to convert towards. So when we look at all of these kind of new patterns or existing patterns or problems of behavior, when we at Agati kind of look at this, we look at this from two perspectives. There's this mental perspective that how people are going to feel and function in the space, kind of the warm, fuzzy, touchy part of that. And then obviously this functional perspective. You know, airports are, I can't say for certain, but are probably one of the highest trafficked areas in the world. So that's going to create very unique functional challenges that you're going to be encountering. So starting off with the mental side, and when we look at this, we look at it from two perspectives. It's a space perspective, and when I say space, I'm not actually talking about the interior architecture, which is important. It's kind of paramount to it, but I'm talking more about the space as in the human space, how it interacts with the product. And then we talk about this element of haven. That's kind of this ultimate kind of achieving of, it's a feeling that we want to create in these spaces with the products. And obviously the architecture interior plays into that, but I'm going to be speaking mostly from a product perspective. So why does this mental thing matter? Why do we care that, oh, people feel good about our furniture, or feel good about in the space? Well, at the end of the day, you know, you can kind of ignore these things, but if you're not addressing some of these issues, you're going to have a lack of utilization of your product. You know, because airports are a unique kind of functional space, you're paying a lot of money for this stuff, and you want to get the most out of it as possible. And so if you're not addressing these kind of elements, these basic kind of cravings that people have, you're just not going to get as effective use out of it. So looking at the first element, space. Like I said, I'm not necessarily talking about the interiors, which is critical, but more from the human being side of it. I'm talking about this kind of personal invisible bubble that exists around all of us. And, you know, kind of this invisible force field. And depending on where you are, who you're with, you know, maybe depending on what country you're in, maybe even where you're located in the country, this bubble shrinks and grows, depending on what it is. Usually we recommend people, you know, when you start violating 12 inches, that kind of becomes the bare minimum. I know, Matt, when you and I were reviewing this, you had some kind of interesting insights that we kind of talked about in relation to this. Matt, are you there? Did I lose you?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I had a mute for 1 second. It's interesting. We talked a little bit on the phone. Anecdotally, for the last 25 years, we've been watching how people interact with each other, certainly in the United States. And I think living in the Midwest now, after coming from both coasts, the amount of personal space grows more than I have seen anywhere in the country. And it really affects how we seat and how we size hold rooms. And it has a ripple effect throughout the entire building.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think, that's kind of a key thing is that it's this, you know, as we go through this, we'll talk about this. There's kind of a core principle factor that everybody needs to consider, but beyond that core, every kind of, you know, airport or space is going to have its own little uniques to it. And so when we think about that, you know, what we're trying to do is we're trying to design products that fit around the human behavior versus changing it. It's really hard to change what people do. People do what they do. I just want to show you this example here. Not that, you know, I'm advocating to put a bunch of giant wooden tables in an airport, but it's just really to illustrate this point. So this is where you see a traditional table configuration, and people sit where they sit. They want to create these barriers. They don't want to sit next to anybody. So the idea is, well, let's just force them to sit at this table. But this is the natural pattern that starts to develop. But what happens there is you have a loss of seating. Paid for three chairs. They're not cheap. That aren't really being that effective or that used. So instead of trying to force people into a pattern of behavior, you know, really want to work with that. So what do they do and how do we make the product work with that? And so this is just to illustrate that. This is the table design that we come up with that. So people are already sitting in this pattern. Why try to force them to sit some way? Let's just make the table around that seating arrangement. So the way this translates a little more directly to airports is in the lounge seating. So these three different type of configurations most people are familiar with. The third one is kind of what's becoming more common in the airport environment. And I'm sure this is no shock to anybody. This is how people sit. You know, you don't want to have someone sitting right next to you. Now, if it's me and my wife traveling, sure, we sit next to each other. But if I'm traveling by myself for work, I'm kind of like, you know, I don't know this person next to me. I don't know. So what's funny is it'll take even when you get to a critical mass, I will still see people sit on a floor or stand next to a window to avoid sitting next to somebody. It's that some, you know, and it depends where you're at, but it's sometimes that large of a phobia to sit next to somebody. So when we look at this, this is where we talk about having that 12-inch factor, that's kind of minimum. When you do that, you will create enough space and you will start to achieve that utilization in the seating. And what's nice is it also creates an element. You also, you know, in airports, what's unique to airports is baggage. You're going to have baggage. And we've seen this changing over the last 10 years. Airlines are charging people more. People are bringing more carry-ons. I don't think there's a flight that I go on nowadays where, you know, it's like, oh, you know, group number 4 or 5, yeah, you got to check your carry-on because we can't fit it. So having that 12 inches there also creates an element where you're not losing seating just to house a bag or something like that. And what we equate this to is this kind of primal instinct to survive. You know, if we look back at our history, you know, we gathered in groups to basically meant our survival. So if you didn't have this kind of tribe or this group you were with, it meant that, oh, I'm, you know, out on my own. I could be attacked by whatever's out in the natural environment. And then this leads us into that kind of next principle we talk about is this haven. You know, when we talk about it internally, we say, well, we want to achieve this feeling that it's like almost like this warm blanket being wrapped around me. I feel very secure in my environment. We first started to know this principle in our Bank Hat series, our booth series of products. We've been doing booths for quite some time. This is a shot from, I don't know, 10, 11, 12 years ago. And this is down in University of Florida. And as you can see here, people sit in it. They're always the first thing to fill up, which is great. The problem is that one person sitting in a booth that's designed for 4 to 6 people. Well, you know, I'm here lecturing on utilization, and we just designed a bunch of product that's not being fully utilized. You know, they're expensive, and we're not getting as much utilization out of it as we want to. Even a shot taken a few years ago, this is North Park University. Still this, you know, people crave this type of environment, but, you know, you know, they got plenty of places to sprawl and work. At the end of the day, still not the utilization we want to achieve. So when we look at that, we say, well, why aren't they using a single-user work area? You know, I think I've seen more of these kind of panel systems pop up in airports. And, you know, sometimes they're used, sometimes they're not. But what they lack is what we call this zone of security. And that's where your back is covered. And that's really the missing element, especially in a high-traffic public space. It's fine in the office. But when you start getting into a more like a heavily trafficked environment, you know, we also do a lot of public library and academic library work, very high traffic environments, you just have this uncomfortable feeling. So when we look at this, we say we want to basically put the person inside the product. So if you take the turn it 90 degrees, and then stick them inside, now you, now you've created the privacy and the security zone that they need, and you start to see that utilization increase. So now you have an environment that's meant for groups, an environment that's meant for individuals. And that's where, you know, you kind of have to answer the question of like, well, what's the best balance for my space? And that's like a whole other topic of discussion that we can talk about for a few hours. But that's where you really can kind of work with your architects, interior designers, manufacturers, and really understand, well, here's how my space works, here's what's going on, and they can make recommendations on, you know, like Matt was alluding to with, you know, with where he's traveling in different countries, okay, that space volume changes, you know, that balance is going to change depending on, you know, how much group or individual you may need. So as you can see here, obviously you got the booth seating that's great for groups, you know, and then, but you still need this kind of individual touchdown spaces. So before I go into the kind of into the lounge example of that, do you have anything to add to that, Matt?
No, I think it's just one, like from a security standpoint too, there's a line of sight, a certain amount of openness that we hear from the TSA and from law enforcement. So that's something to always factor into your refuge zone.
Yeah, that's a really good point, actually. You actually don't need like wall, like crazy high walls to achieve this feeling. Actually, everything that I'm showing you here as an example is only 48 inches high. And we do that deliberately. One, it's to achieve that kind of haven effect. Also two, from not a far distance away, you have line of sight on what's going on. You can't see exactly what's happening in an enclosure. But you can see, okay, someone's occupying that, you know, with maybe a quick glance around, you can see what's happening in there. Obviously there's greater security concern in an airport. We deal with it maybe not as a threat. But you know, in the academic, library world, that is one of the number one concern. Like, oh, I got to make sure I don't know what two students are doing in that, you know, enclosure in there. So same principle, maybe exacerbated from different perspectives, but you don't need to go very high to kind of achieve these things. And so when we look at this in the lounge seating, because I don't anticipate you guys putting tons of these single-user workstations in there, they're not incredibly footprint intensive, but the principles still apply. So you got to, you know, if you have your 12 inches, okay, great, you're going to increase, you're going to start maximizing utilization. You can start working panels into these things to help even elevate that to the next level. And I would not say start putting panels and everything in between people. That's also not going to be incredibly effective. It's, once again, a balance. But when you start looking at it, well, you know, everybody's seen a traditional four-chair grouping or something like that, and one person sits down, and then maybe a second person sits down. You know, if you've got a group of four, sure, you'll start to increase, reach a good utilization factor. But you're going to, typically, if it's one or two people, the bags are going to go on the other chairs. Or just sit empty, the bags are going to go next to them, they're going to be lost chairs. So if you look at that same kind of, you know, four chairs, turn them around, add screens to them, you will increase that utilization factor. When you sit down in this, once again, only 48 inches, you can see there's actually pretty good sight lines around this. You don't have to have that much enclosed. But it's just enough to give that sense of security to that individual. And you will get four people to sit in these. Not only that, you're taking up 80 square feet. So depending on your airport, your gate, wherever these are going, footprint intensity is a factor. So if I can achieve, you know, a good critical mass, I can put the same number of chairs, a less footprint, give it a more airy feeling, and increase the utilization just by thinking about these things a little differently. So on the mental side, we talk about space and haven. If you guys have deeper questions about those, we can answer those at the end, or I believe we get a copy of the questions at the end, and I'm happy to go deeper into them. But I want to spend more time on the functional side of things. Obviously, like I said when I said in the beginning, this is a very unique environment. We've only really made furniture for public spaces. That's our focus. And the airport being probably the most heavily abused out of all of them. You have tens and tens and tens of millions of people traveling through an airport at a time. I mean, it's kind of crazy how much abuse this product will take compared to other environments. So we look at it from a comfort and a durability perspective. The first thing is comfort and durability. Why this? It's the longevity. We want to increase the longevity of the furniture as much as possible. You're spending a lot of money on this stuff. We want to make sure you're getting the most use out of it as we can. And obviously that ties a little bit into the mental side, but really, you know, how is it going to wear? How is it going to hold up? How am I going to maintain it? that's really going to increase the life of the product. So from comfort standpoint, usually we go through this, and I just like to make people aware because I don't think people always understand the simple nuances between product and different seats and ergonomics and things like that. And it kind of ties into the utilization factor, but we usually lump it with the functional side of things. So you've got, a lounge sit. You've got this kind of hybrid, which is a work lounge. You've got, what we call a work long. So kind of someone's going to work, they're going to spend a longer time. And then you have what we call like a work, and it's work quick. I'm just going to drop down 15, 20 minutes at most, check an email, power something, get a little bit of juice on something, and then I'm off. So when we look at from the lounge, I just want to kind of like touch on the nuances between them. So lounge, we say, falls into the 20-20 rule, where you're going to have 20 degrees on the recline of the back and about 20 inches depth in the seat. Now, these aren't like exact numbers. It's just more to say that you're going to have a much greater recline in a deeper seat and even a lower sit on a lounge chair. And it's really meant to be an independent chair. It should not be pulled up to another piece of furniture like a high table or something like that. No, we'll go into that here in a minute. But with lounge activity, it's an interesting product because a lot of people want to work in a lounge, but it's really, ergonomically, it's not the best for them. I mean, they're going to kind of do it, and that's actually a challenge we're trying to take on right now because, like I said before, as much as I'd like to change people's behaviors, it's really difficult. So how do we create that effective workspace for them? But usually you'll see from a time perspective, people will spend, 30, 60 minutes. In an airport, you'll find this more because people are going to be waiting a little longer. But a lot of the public spaces, the lounge is usually a quicker thing. 10, 15 minutes, I'm checking something, I'm waiting for something, and then I'm off to the next activity. Then the next element is where we talk about this work long. Basically, it's kind of a table and chair configuration. And these fall into a 10, 18, 18 rule, where the back is obviously going to be much more vertical. And then you got to have a little higher sit and a little shallower sit. But the key element is in the verticality, you want the back support. When you're working at a table, if you sit down in a chair and your back isn't up against that chair, at least your lower back, the chair isn't sized and ergonomically set up for that use. It should be for something else. You shouldn't be what we call perching on that chair. And then the same thing applies because we see a lot of high tables in the airport, which actually a really great place, like I said, for refuge, helping to create this like space and haven effect. Because when people are walking around, especially in a high traffic environment, if you're sitting down at a table, people are walking over you. When you're at the high table, they're at the same headline as you. You don't feel like you have to create as many barriers between them. But the principle still applies. You're still taking that same ergonomic position. You're just lifting it up. So when you're looking at stools, you still want to check, hey, do I have this back support here? Is my back being supported in the lower back, if not starting to get closer to the shoulders? Stools typically don't have a higher back. It's rare. It can be lead to a stability problem. But you want to have at least support in the lower back there. And so we talked about this hybrid earlier, where it's this work lounge element, and this is where basically the booth seating comes in, booth or banquettes. And this is actually where we see most of the confusion that, they have the booth should have the same kind of sit principles as the quote-unquote work long, basically a side or pull-up chair. And it's really about that back support. And so this is where people see it's cushy. Oh, it must be a lounge. So they'll sometimes flop them. They'll put lounge in where it should be a booth or put booth seating in where there really should be a lounge. Because a booth seat's actually pretty uncomfortable if you don't have a table in front of you. And really there that difference comes into play is into the back here, where you can see that, the work lounge has a much more vertical back. And if you look at the lounge in there, there's probably going to be about a 10-degree difference in that back. So this is where we talk about that perching element. So not only do you have a deeper seat and you have more reclined back, you're going to start to scoop forward on that chair. And at that point, you bought a bench. You might as well just not even put it back on the chair because it's not serving any purpose. It's too low to provide any kind of security. And it's too far back to provide any kind of support. And so usually these are the kind of the longer stay activities. dining, writing work, computer work, you know, for that business traveler, they're probably going to gravitate towards something like this. For me personally, if I have like a 5-6 o'clock flight, I actually leave for the airport at like noon when the security lines aren't that bad, and I just go and work out at the airport. I get a ton of stuff done. I have people asking me a gazillion questions. So, you know, it's interesting. It becomes a haven away from my own office sometimes. But I'm gravitating towards these type of spaces because I want to be able to drop my computer. I'll need access to power, which we'll talk about. But it makes a difference having that kind of that support in your back, because when you don't, you start leaning forward. You're going to start to get tension in your neck and your shoulders if you're working for over 30 and you get up to 60 minutes. So the next element is this is the kind of the high table. So it's usually around 42 inches, 39, 42. And like we talked about, it's really meant for quick work. 10, 15 minutes, you know, most ergonomic people don't recommend standing for more than, you know, 15, 20 minutes at a time. But they provide a great space for access to power, drop down, you know, plug a phone in, plug a laptop in, get 20 minutes of juice on before I jump on my flight. So when we look at this on kind of a scale of time, I just like to show this to people just to think about this, because what this starts to tie into is like, oh, when I'm starting to think about my space, I don't really want to be intermixing kind of different activities, short-term lounge versus long-term lounge versus long-term work, things like that, because then it's going to kind of start disrupting the space. So, you know, you've got lounge where you've got this kind of quick touchdown table, high table, no seating, touchdown. And then you have, you know, the lounge, which can jump. You either got kind of like 15 minutes or jumps, so like 30, 60 minutes, 60 to 90 minutes. And then you got the work, and then the work lounge, which usually tends to be the 30 to 90 minute category. So when you're laying out these spaces, I don't want to be putting a bunch of quick touchdown 15 minute lounge spots like in the middle of a bunch of long working activity, because then it's going to be disruptive to the people that are trying to do, you know, longer work or a longer stay. Do you have anything to add there, Matt, before we kind of jump into durability?
Yeah, I think, you know, stepping back, I think what we're seeing, too, certainly in the last 5 years, is this mix of power tables, high tops, lounge seating, all mixed in post-secure with the beam seating. And traditionally in hold rooms, we used to just figure out how many seats we needed based on the prevailing largest aircraft, and then we'd adjust to that. But I think that dynamic is changing along with the behavioral psychology of the space. And what we're finding is that people, as long as they still can maintain some visual connection with their gate, they're seeking out these areas of refuge. So it's not just a one-size-fits-all solution.
Mm-hmm. That's a really good point. So just moving on to durability. So like we keep saying here, you know, this is a unique environment, and it's driven by the public. And the public is your worst enemy. People do not care about your product. They don't know the painstaking efforts that you went through to select it, pick out finishes, materials, do the arrangements. Unfortunately, it's just part of human nature that when we don't own it, it's just we just care about it less. And so then, you know, here, like I've said before, that's just part of the things you have to factor in. If you look at the scale of abuse, this is just as an illustration, like residential furniture is kind of at the lowest end. I mean, it's in your home. You own it. You know, you're going to take the best care of it. If you have little kids, you know, it's actually really – I have a 1.5-year-old. They don't care about anything. They'll destroy whatever. But obviously, as they get older and they purchase furniture, then they start to care about it. But it's usually kind of – I put it at the kind of lowest sense of – and of durability that you need. And then you have, like, prison industry furniture that's going to be heavily, heavily abused. Airport furniture kind of falls just short of that. And it's just really related to the amount of traffic. I mean, the amount of traffic that goes through the space is kind of mind-blowing. That if you're not, you know, if I wasn't doing this, you know, if I wasn't kind of working in this industry, it's kind of, like, almost unfathomable, the amount of people that move through these spaces. So durability, kind of breaking it down, not just from this large bucket of durability, but looking at like construction and maintenance. And what I kind of want to go through here is this is still going to be kind of high level. Like I said, there's actually a number of topics that we can just spend hours talking about. But I want to just give you guys, especially on the construction and maintenance side, just good questions to ask as you're selecting product, because like Matt was saying, it's not just throw a bunch of bean seeding in there and, and then kind of figure it out. It's really like you have these new kind of furniture elements that are entering the space. And how do you know what you're getting makes sense? As we're doing airport projects, that's kind of the first thing. Like, oh, I've had beam seating forever, and it, you know, it holds up. I mean, yeah, I've got some issues there. I can, switch some stuff out or whatever, but I want to move to this kind of, this new type of environment. How do I know what makes sense? It's very common for us to do a furniture selection, put a piece out there for 3 to 4 months, make sure it works, make sure this is what you, not just from a durability standpoint, but also from a functional standpoint, because when you're looking at just from the outside, it's really hard to understand, well, what's underneath. So this is just kind of giving you enough information to be dangerous, as I like to say. So from the construction standpoint, I'm kind of just going to break down a lounge chair and a table, basically. The lounge chair is kind of what, we're doing a lot of these lounge chairs in the airport spaces, and we're seeing a lot of these kind of come into that environment. So how do you know what you're getting, what makes sense? And we see them because they check a lot of boxes. You're able to create a lounge environment. You're able to add privacy. You can integrate power in them. So a lot of the things that we talked about that are things that we need to speak to, these furniture solutions are able to do that. So when you look at it just from a frame construction standpoint, there's kind of roughly two basic ways to make frames for these type of seating. You got a plywood and you have a poplar frame. Now the poplar frame construction is kind of an old archaic way. It's more common in residential, but it's never going to hold up to the environment that you need. And, the plywood's great, but even plywood makes a difference. So anything under 7/8 inch plywood is just not going to live up. You're not going to be able to get the mortise and tenon joints that you need in there and get the rope. You're just not going to have enough material. The 7/8 inch plywood, it takes a lot to flex it. It provides really good screw surface area for it, just the thickness of it. And we don't recommend any poplar frame. So if you're starting to talk to somebody and you ask them, well, what's the frame construction? They say poplar. Just stop right there. Do yourself a favor. That's going to be kindling in 2 months. We've had good learning lessons. Anything we've worked with that goes under 7 days, it may be fine for some environments, an office, a low use kind of library or healthcare, but not to the environment that you guys are going to be working in. And it's kind of silly, but like heavier is better. I mean, it sounds silly, but it's just, you need the thickness of the material. You need the amount of material. If you start picking up a lounge chair and it's really light and airy feeling, it's just not going to last. You got to have so much kind of mass in there for it to work. And when you look at it, what also adds to that mass is no framed out arms. There's two ways to kind of construct it. You can frame out an arm. We recommend, it should be a solid piece of wood, a solid piece of plywood, and then kind of framed out blocking. So you have two solid pieces on either side, which adds to the weight. For example, one of our chairs, the two arms actually weigh more than the entire chair itself. What happens with these things, it's a perfect place for someone to perch real quick. Oh, I'm just going to sit on the arm of the chair, and I weigh 300, 400 pounds. It's just going to take that abuse. And it's not like I'm just going to sit on it once. I'm going to sit on it how many times? I'm going to drop my bag on it how many times? It's got to be able to withstand the environment. And also, too, having solid on either side also helps the fabric maintain its shape. So if you were able to kind of push in on that arm and you're not feeling something soft, that fabric's going to loosen up over time. So moving away from the frame construction, there's obviously, so the frame going to be probably the most substantial part of your chair, but the foam is like kind of the second weakest part of your chair. It will break down, and it makes a big difference in how the chair will be look and shape will hold over time. So less is more when it comes to foam. The more foam you have, it's just the more it'll break down and the quicker it'll break down. So if you're able to achieve a comfort level that you need with a minimal amount of foam, you're going to hold that, maybe some of those crisp lines and the shape of that chair over a longer time. As you start to go over 3 inches, it's going to start to look funky pretty quick. You can kind of get up there. I mean, 3 inches is like the maximum. Our booth seating goes to about 3 inches, and that's kind of where we stop it. If we start really going over that, you start to get this. You start to get the pooling and puddling quick. Now, in some of these chairs' defenses, it's not just the foam. Fabric plays into this. The brown chair on the right here, This is actually a pretty well-constructed chair. I don't exactly remember who constructs it. This is actually one of the lounges here in Chicago. But the arm there is solid. That seat foam looks like the foam is a little too soft, probably for, in my opinion. But I think the fabric is also playing an element to this because you can kind of see it on the arms. It's just really not holding up and staying as tight on the arms. And we'll talk more about fabric as we go through here. But you can see, if that foam is too soft, you're going to get pooling and puddling pretty quick in these chairs. So you look at the chair, obviously it's mostly going to be plywood, minimal amount of foam. And the foam should be a mixture. It's not should just be a piece of foam on a board, especially if you have chairs that have harder, crisper lines. You're going to want a lot more rigidity and structure in there. So elements of structural foam, medium, high density foam kind of mixed throughout the product. Next thing is I see a lot of people, and I'm seeing this less and less, but tight-fitted seats, no loose cushions. The loose cushions, one, are crummy catchers, and they start to curl and bend pretty quick. So it makes your furniture look pretty tired. I think the idea was, it's a cushion, I can replace it, it takes wear, I don't have to replace the whole chair, which is a really good principle, but it looks pretty tired pretty quick. So it's kind of working against you. And the last thing is the fabric on these chairs. The fabric is your weakest part. And I'm going to go deeper into fabric when we go into the kind of the maintenance side. But you can have a great frame. You can have great foam. It can be constructed really, really well, like that brown chair. I mean, it can't speak to the foam, but I would say that's pretty well-constructed chair. Fabric, it's the weakest part, and it's probably the most used part. So it's really important to really be really critical about your fabric selection. Before I jump into tables, do you have any additions to that, Matt?
No, I just think that, certainly heavier is always better. But if things are going to be moved, because people will sometimes readjust just based on whatever environment they're in, you want to make sure that it is movable without damaging these floor underneath.
Mm-hmm. That's a really good point. That's a really good point. I should have included that in here. When it comes to moving stuff, and it sounds silly, take very good close at the glides underneath these products. So what we've learned over the 30-some years we've been doing this, we manufacture our own legs ourselves, and we make our own glides. Because what we found is that if you buy a source glide and the glide doesn't meet the end of the leg, just that little bit of carpet bunching up under there creates enough force on a 100-pound chair or two chairs that are 100 pounds with a table in between with a stone that's 50 pounds, 250-pound chair configuration, that little bit of carpet that builds up there creates enough force where you'll start to disintegrate that configuration. So that's a really good point. We had an interesting scenario with Tampa where they were moving the chairs every single night to vacuum. So we're kind of like, oh, wow, we didn't kind of anticipate that much movement. But that's a reality of what's going to be dealt with. The cleaning people may come through every night and vacuum and then have to slide them out of the way and slide them back into place. That's a good point. Next thing is tables. So, metal-based tables, incredibly common in airports. You can buy a lot of different metal bases from a lot of people. It's hard to go wrong. I mean, usually the metal bases are constructed all pretty well. It's not going to be your biggest risk factor. Your work surfaces or your top surfaces are going to be the biggest kind of risk. And so you have these kind of different categories. You got solid wood, wood veneer, plastic laminate, PVC edge, solid surface, and quartz. Well, we don't recommend any wood veneer you can get away with some solid wood, but they're going to be a lot of maintenance in this kind of high traffic environment. And it's really what comes down to the cleaning of the table. It's going to be sprayed and cleaned down after everybody, almost after someone sits there every single time. So just those cleaning chemicals alone are incredibly harsh on finishes. You can use these really heavy, two-part epoxy, polyurethane, catalyzed finishes, which are good, but those chemicals are really harsh, and over time they will wear down. You can get away with plastic laminate if it's a low-traffic area. We do tons of plastic laminate, obviously public library, academic library, 24/7 academic libraries, it holds up. But even the heaviest 24/7 academic library won't even compare to like the top 50 airports in the country and maybe not even the top 100. So if it's a low traffic area or a low traffic wear point on the furniture, it's totally fine. But if it's, you know, on the surface of it, I caution you. The next common thing is a lot of solid surface, a lot of quartz going in these spaces. And I get questions, well, what's the difference? Basically, solid surface is a polymer. It's a plastic. It's in the plastic families. And quartz is a man-made stone. So it's not granite, but it's, you know, it's stone, basically. And when you kind of look at them and start comparing the two, they end up being similar in cost. Now, there are some factors in what you're doing with them, but they're similar in cost at the end of the day. Then you also have the durability factor. Quartz, a lot more durable. You will get let me just go to that thing. And then moldable. The solid surface is great because you can build these beautiful monolithic pieces, seam it all together in the field, polish it out. I mean, really, you can make really beautiful stuff with it. But if you look at it from the maintenance standpoint, quartz is much better. The solid surface is great when you stick with lighter colors, but they always say, like, well, it's soft, but you can just buff it right back out. That's true, but you're going to spend so much time buffing this stuff out, and it takes so much energy and force to damage that quartz that you're almost never going to get there versus spending some guy or gal every 2 weeks buffing out scratches out of the desk. You're just better off kind of going the quartz direction. So that's something we just recommend. I mean, it's up to the individuals, and they will know their spaces better than us, but we kind of tend to recommend that. And so then looking at these two chairs, just going real quick, because this is something that kind of comes up that is a little unique, it's just buying an installation. So, you know, usually there's, I just wanted to touch on this real fast, there's kind of three ways that kind of the buying cycle goes through this. So usually we're either working through a GC, we're working through a furniture dealer, where you got a lot of different pieces, the dealer's going to aggregate that and manage the kind of the purchasing and project management of that, or it's going direct. There's no right or wrong. There's just kind of what makes sense for your situation. And every manufacturer should be able to work kind of however you guys need. But moving on to the installation side, you know, lots of times these are large scale installations, and then if it's a new building, it's one thing, but if it's an active terminal, it's really tricky. So the delivery and time, you know, if it's phased versus all at once. So those are the kind of things you need to ask yourself as you're starting this. Hey, am I going to phase it? Can I have all the gates go down, you know, one time at night and then go back up the next morning? Or do we need to do three gates one night, three gates the next night, however it may work? And then what time of day? Lots of times, and especially in the active terminals, we have to go in at 8 o'clock. So it's just when you're thinking about that, that's the stuff you want to communicate to people because it's going to drive costs. Is really why we just wanted to touch on it real quick because those are the, you know, if you got to do after hours, prevailing wage, it's time and a half, it's going to drive up the cost of things. And if you have to do it that way, you have to do it that way. That's just, you know, that's just maybe the nature of the environment. But those are things to consider early on in as you're working on the project. Do you have anything else to add, Matt, before I kind of jump into maintenance here real quick?
Yeah, I mean, the primarily we do phased terminal projects, okay. And we run into this challenge all the time. When do we buy it? Because this might be multi-year construction, and where do we store it if we buy it in bulk, or can we still get the same fabric dye lots and all those consistent throughout a multi-year project? So it's just always worth asking yourself what is optimal condition.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Yeah, especially from the material side, you will get fluctuations in materials. Now, as long as you're not like doing a section of a gate and then marrying up with the next section of the gate, you shouldn't get enough fluctuation that you won't, like, you shouldn't notice it. But you may run in the risk of that they just stop producing it, and that happens. It's beyond frustrating. But it can be a possibility. So what's the contingency plan after that? I think we've been doing a lot of work with Logan, and Logan, each kind of phase is always a little bit different, and I don't know if that's intentional for them to kind of shield themselves from that, so I don't have to, you know, so they just decide to stop making a pattern or something, you know, I'm only maybe hurting a small segment of the airport. So jumping into maintenance, so I want to just kind of dissect the same product from a maintenance standpoint, and why this matters is security. And we talked about kind of in the install part, it's not easy to get into these places to maintain things. It's lots of times has to be done at night, which means it's, you know, more expensive. Prevailing wage, stuff's not cheap. So how do we make it, you know, it still has to be maintained. You're not going to, it's unavoidable. things are going to get damaged. So how do we do it in such a way that it's not so painful for us? So really looking at chairs, how do chairs break apart? Can they break apart easily? Do they break down into their components? So I don't have to replace an entire chair. I can just swap out an arm. I can swap out a seat, swap out a leg. Number of airports we work with, they'll buy added stock. They'll just keep 20 arms, 20 legs, 10 seats, 10 backs, or whatever on hand, and they'll swap them out, and when they start running through a bunch, then we'll set them out, be reupholstered, and back in. So this way they don't really have a chair configurations out of service for more than a night or something. So just those type of things, and like, you know, when these new products are coming to space, how am I going to take care of these things? Asking those questions, like, you know, if the arm doesn't bolt, unbolt, or if it's attached to a table, how much effort does it take? Do I have to take an entire configuration part to pull this chair out? We really want to get things down to the component level as much as we can. The next thing is fabric. So like I said, fabric is going to be your weakest part. And I have more discussions about fabric on these jobs than anything else. Even electrical, which is really complicated, usually we're able to get that figured out. Fabric is your most vulnerable part of these projects. And so just breaking down fabrics real quick, you've got wovens versus faux leathers. And just so we kind of understand the kind of difference between these, so wovens, they do better on puncture. The faux leathers do much better on abrasion. Like, people are familiar with that double rub test. But I want to interject here. When you see a double rub test or a Weisenbeek test, don't be lulled into things that have millions of double rubs or a million double rubs or 800,000 double rubs. Double rubs don't necessarily translate into true performance. I've had fabric that has a million double rubs that have disintegrated after a year and a half, and I have vinyls that have 100,000 that look great 5 years later. They're not a true test. If you're pulling up something that's like a woven, which you're going to be 30, 40, 50, 60, 70,000 double rubs, yeah, I'd have a bit concern. But if you start getting over 100,000, 200,000, it's kind of irrelevant at that point. So don't be lulled in that false sense of security with that. Cleaning. Faux leathers are better to clean. They wipe away things. Now, let me just take a minute here too. Cleaning is also one of the most common ways to damage your fabric. And this is where we run into the biggest problem. Fabric companies will say, oh, I've only had 3 warranty issues. That is most likely true. I have no reason to doubt what they say. It's the gray area that it's not a warranty issue because someone used the wrong cleaning solution and it's delaminating. They don't consider that a warranty issue. That's an abuse, a misuse of the product. But that is 9 times out of 10 the reason why the fabric's failing, or why the fabric company will say that it's failing. So the faux leathers you use, you clean. That being said, you have to be very careful about the cleaning solutions you use because that's the first thing the fabric company will say. And then the next thing is the repairing. Now, wovens can be sewn up and repaired. Once a faux leather's punctured, it's punctured. You can try some glue or whatever, but I've never seen it work. Maybe they'll come out with something in the future. It's really not repairable. That's why we want to break those pieces down into the component level. So we can just reupholster and get that component back out into the field. Wovens, much better for low traffic. We do wovens all the time with the same barrier. They perform well in low traffic environments. High traffic, they can be a little finicky, especially with the right cleaning solutions, but still today, the faux leathers are better for the high traffic. Until something comes along differently, that's kind of where we're at with them. And even in faux leathers, I just want to kind of dive a little deeper in here real quick. Because there is a difference, and this is where a lot of people are having problems, is you've got vinyls, polyurethanes, and silicones. So I do not currently recommend any polyurethanes. I really recommend people use vinyls. They're tried and true. They've been around for a long time. Polyurethanes are becoming more and more popular. They're great for the environment, and that's really why. They boast these 100 or million double rubs. Like I said, don't be fooled. You know, lured in that false sense of security there. There's something, the way that polys are manufactured is that they are put onto a backing with a glue and the vinyls are molded right into the backing. I don't know what it is, but we see almost a 10 times higher quote-unquote failure rate, basically delaminating, most likely caused by cleaning solution with a polyurethane versus a vinyl. Now, the vinyls will get damaged by poor cleaning solutions, don't get me wrong, but it takes a lot longer for them to show that damage and wear. What they'll do is they'll start to dry out and crack. So even if you get a little dryness cracking in it, it's still not so distracting that someone will sit in it. The polyurethane, the top coat literally just peels away. And it'll happen within, you know, a year. In your guys' environment, it could start happening within 6 months.
So because I have not been able to replicate problems in a lab and really understood why these are happening, we've had so many problems with it, I just don't recommend using them until they get better. I don't recommend you guys being the guinea pigs on that. Silicones are really cool, really great, a lot of really nice properties, stain resistant, ink resistant, really great wipe away. They are manufactured in the same principle as a polyurethane. They're newer. They are very stretchy as well, a lot stretchier than the polyurethane, so you could run into a much higher rate of pooling and puddling. We just don't know enough about them. And to not really know enough about a product and to have it go into a crazy kind of traffic environment, I just don't recommend it right now. They're new. I want to like them. They check a lot of boxes, but there's just not enough data on them. Once something's been on the market, it takes like 5 years to really start to understand. Because when you put it on the thing, you don't notice it day one. Oh, it's pooling day one. No, it takes 6 months, and then it starts to show a little bit of wear. Oh, but that's not that bad. And then a year later, like, oh, wow, now it's really starting to wear. Oh, it's really pooling and puddling. Now you're in year two, and you're trying to figure out, and it's, you know. So you get 2.5, 3 years in, and you're like, oh, my God, this is clearly not the right fabric. So it just takes time for that stuff to show up. So breaking this, breaking these elements down, so from a maintenance standpoint, going back to tables, you know, the tabletop is kind of, you know, from a construction standpoint, you've got a higher square point. From a maintenance standpoint, the power that you're starting to put in these things is going to be your weakest point in the product. These power units will break. We use Burn Electric for our power. We've had a really good success rate with them. But we did have a power unit failure. It was a manufacturer failure. They stood behind the product, which was really great of them. But we had to go out and we had to unbolt however many tables out of the floor and replace the power at 8 o'clock at night, you know, over 2 days. So it's a real challenge. So thinking ahead on how we're going to manage that power. So make sure you have easy access to these elements. They're not, I don't know when they'll break. Most commonly that the power plugs will last almost forever. They're rated for millions and millions of plug in and out. But we're seeing USBs come in more and more. They're a lot more delicate. People put them in backwards. The contacts, it's a lot less metal in there. And you may not know that they're going to break. I mean, how many times I've just put a USB in, oh, it's not charging, I go to the next one. So you may not even know for quite some time when they've broken. But the USBs, they will break faster. So how are we going to access these things quickly? Maybe tool-free to consider that I can just swap these out, swap them back in, and go on 10, 15 minutes, and then we go down the road. That's where the table on the right here was kind of designed out of. So this table can be bolted down, and you can take those power units out without any tools. It's not the sexiest design. We will admit that. But when we look at these things, we kind of have to make a sacrifice here and there about, okay, I know it's not going to be the sexiest now, but when 15 power units fail and I got to unbolt 15 tables and it cost me $7,000 in labor to replace $200, $400 in power units, you're going to be like, yeah, we got to do this better. So before I start wrapping up, Matt, do you have anything else to add in there?
No, I just wanted to throw in that the FAA, when you talk about eligibility for federal funds with regard to seating, they talk about they deem fixed seating as eligible. So I recommend to anyone to speak with your ADO if you want to figure out what their definition of fixed is.
Okay. So we're going to start wrapping up here. So we kind of, as we're going through here, just trying to give you an idea of what we're seeing, especially from a product perspective, as we kind of go into the new evolution of airports. You know, as we talked about, it's been changing due to increase in travel, longer security, people arriving earlier to the airport, which is pushing up the dwell time, which is leading into all these new elements that we're having to start consider, whether it's with just lounging, kind of naturally occurring problems that are becoming worse, creating spaces, how do we create more work, how do we create more dining elements, how do we really maximize the amount of power these buildings were constructed 10, 15 years ago, are underpowered. It's probably, you know, after the fabric, power is probably our second biggest challenge when we're working on these spaces. And so looking at it from these two kind of perspectives, you know, while depending on what you're at, you know, we, you know, in a library and something like that, we're spending a lot more time focused on the mental side, but it's still an element that you have to kind of consider in there to really maximize the use of your furniture, looking at the space, how do we create these haven effects for people. And then obviously the functional side, like I said, like we keep saying, it's an incredibly unique environment. There's really nothing else like it on the planet. You're going to be dealing with, you know, comfort. You know, comfort really kind of ties into that utilization factor, but how do you really manage the construction and the maintenance of these products over its life cycle? I mean, when we're selling you something, we really want to make sure you're getting every ounce of mileage out of these pieces of furniture because you're spending really good money on them. And at the end of the day, it's really about balancing all of these elements. So we talked about there's always this core 80% principle that everybody needs to hit, but each environment is slightly different. So, yeah, okay, am I achieving my space factors? Am I really creating these haven environments? Okay, I've checked the boxes on the chairs. Yeah, these are really going to hold up. Oh, the power bars are going to, you know, I can swap power out. You know, people can sit at them, stand at them. Yeah, you got to hit all those core principles, but then it's like, okay, now that I hit all these things, how much of what do I use? Where does it go? How do I really, you know, get down to those other levels? That my space is slightly different than other spaces. You know, what is my type of travel versus other people? And then it's really kind of going through and balancing that out. So that's kind of what we have for you today. I don't know if you have anything else to add just here at the end, Matt, before we start taking questions.
No, I think you've covered it wonderfully.
Very good. So we're ready for a few questions, and we probably have many more questions than we have time. I just wanted to assure you that we're keeping all of the questions, and what we don't get to right now, we will have our presenters get back in touch with you in terms of answering your questions. Okay. Joe, are you ready for, Matt, ready for some questions?
Sure.
Absolutely.
Okay. The first question that came in was, does the concept of personal space extend from baggage as well?
I don't know if I fully understand the question. Yes, that bubble doesn't really change whether you have a bag with you or not, if that's the way the question is being answered. The bag will be used to create, to keep, fend people off out of your bubble. So lots of times, you know, that's where if you have seats in a row, you'll see someone put the seat, you know, the bag on the seat next to him and from the seat next to him to kind of like just say, hey, look, you really can't enter my personal bubble. My bag's here. I got this barrier here. So if I'm understanding the question, no, like your bag doesn't, you know, increase that bubble factor, but it's used more of like a barrier to keep, you know, the world out away from you.
Yeah, we've always considered the bag to be just an extension of the self. And then we factor that into the square footage required per person to determine room sizes.
Okay. Thank you. And a question that's also has come up regards the fire retardancy of materials. Could either of you address that, please?
Yeah, Matt, do you want to tackle that maybe from an architecture perspective or –
Yeah, I mean, largely, it is the rare airport that is more than two stories, and it is, they're almost always sprinkled. So the fire retardancy out of best practices is something we look at, but from a good standpoint, it's not a driving factor for selection.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, from a material standpoint on the furniture, it's common nowadays. I mean, I don't want to say everything, but especially if you're looking at stuff that's going in a commercial environment, it's everything's kind of graded in to meet a flammability standard. So usually everything in there, the fabric, the foam, the wood, has all a flammability rating, and depending on what your kind of local area is, they can tell you, and then you can pull the test data. You know, or someone can provide you. I mean, it was not an airport, but it was a very unique scenario where most people will accept Cal 117 or something like that. But they had a very unique one that was, I can't remember the acronym, but it was almost the same as a Cal 117, and everybody had the testing for it. But there was just this one entity that said, hey, no, I have to have this specific one. So usually it's, you know, when we're doing it, we're kind of, we won't necessarily fire rate like the whole component. Now there is some uniqueness in the Massachusetts and Boston area where you have to provide a flammability test on specific products. But that's to the level like you have to have the actual fabric in there and you have to do a burn test on that. That's one of the environments that we really only run into that with. And I think even then it's like in non-sprinkled buildings or something like that. Massachusetts seems to be the most stringent on it, or maybe not even Massachusetts, it could just be the Boston area. So in those instances, we'll actually produce a chair and burn it and produce the burn safety on it. And if you have those requirements, then you need to, you usually, most often, I've never seen done well, you need to have a barrier cloth, basically, to stop. It's another layer between the fabric and the foam to stop the flame to getting down to the foam. But most vinyls, they, you know, to meet the flammability, they should be self-extinguishing and things like that.
Very good. Thank you, Jill. Another question that came in is, how are food delivery services, quick grab concessions, impacting the seating type in holding areas? Matt?
Yeah, I'll speak to that one because we wrestle with this one a lot. You know, there's this, always, in airports, there's a drive to increase revenue beyond aeronautical revenue. And from a concession standpoint, their point is that they just would love to be able to drive each passenger to have more of a buy. And so there, certainly in my local airport, there's this growth in this iPad at your kiosk, and they're replacing beam seats. The challenge with that is if you go overboard, it becomes very, very difficult from a circulation standpoint and from a queuing standpoint to actually use the hold rooms as they were designed. And there's fire marks as well from an evacuation route. So I just caution anyone from going overboard just trying to produce revenue.
Okay, very good. Another question that's come up regards the length of furniture. One of our listeners says that TSA will want to inspect under furniture as well. What do you recommend as the height above the ground for furniture?
Usually we're really not going much less than 5 inches. It really wasn't a driver for a TSA inspection. It's more just from a cleaning purpose that you want to have enough space that someone can get a low profile vacuum under it if necessary, or, you know, sweep underneath it or get underneath it just from cleaning and maintenance purposes. 5 inches is probably as low as you want to go. You're just not going to be able to get underneath it much more. I know even, when we start violating 5 inches, for instances, it's hard to install even, try to get under there, bolt things together, access power, you know, like we talked about, accessing those power units, you start to violate that kind of becomes an issue. And it also becomes an issue, too, is that the lower you get to the ground, it's a greater bump factor. So the vacuum is now bumping into it. Bags are now, you know, the wheels are starting to bump into it. So from that kind of functional standpoint, 5 would be the minimum. I don't know if you have anything to add to that, Matt.
Yeah, just from my discussions with the TSA, the 5 to 6 inches is acceptable to them.
Okay. Very good. I know we're running a little bit long, and as I mentioned, any questions that we don't answer on the broadcast, we will get back to you with answers. Are you up for one more question, Joe?
Sure.
Okay. And this kind of relates to the introduction. How much observation occurs to watch how people, both passengers and employees, interact with existing furniture before new solutions are designed?
I'm assuming that's kind of a product development question for us. I mean,
yes.
I don't know if I can throw a number of hours at it, and I didn't include this kind of in this presentation just for a time factor, but really everything we design at Agati, and I can speak to really only Agati and I guess Radio Flyer where I worked previously, everything really is designed from observing human behavior. We really fight hard, and it's hard to do this as a designer because, I mean, I have 1,000 ideas a day, and I as much as I love all my ideas, they're not all good ideas. So we really want to make sure when we're designing these things, we start from observing human behavior and creating a product that works with that. versus I got a cool idea and then trying to find things to justify it. Because those products never work. I mean, maybe you'll get sell some here or whatever, but when they get out in the field, they just don't work. So it's hard to kind of quantify, but at least from our design standpoint, everything is driven off of what we observe people doing. And I emphasize observe because we really won't get into a lot of surveys. And I do this very deliberately. I noticed kind of early in my career when we'd go to focus groups, and this was when I was at Radio Flyer, and we, you know, I had a mom that swore up and down, and we were testing a push-pull wagon concept, and she swore up and down, I would never push a wagon. That's crazy. That's so stupid. Da, 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 da. And so we gave her a wagon that was, she could have pulled. It was kind of in such a fashion that it's like, you know, designed to just see what was going to happen. She pushed that wagon around the room 3 times. So I think people just aren't always self-aware of what's going on. I mean, I guess me as a designer, I am self-aware to know that I'm not even always self-aware that, you know, I could be doing something and, you know, my father and I work closely on our product development together, and he'll be standing outside and he's like, wait, you see what you just did there? I'm like, what? And he's like, look how you got in there. And I'm like, oh, I didn't even notice that. So really a lot of it is really driven from observing that human behavior. So I don't know if that answered that question, but that's kind of really what leads our product development.
And once the furnishings are arriving at airports, we love to ask maintenance to move the chairs around into different areas and watch how people interact with the furnishings and if some better areas are better than others. And oftentimes it surprises us.
Yeah, that's a good point too, Matt. I think that's, I touched on that really briefly in the earlier part. It's not uncommon, and I encourage people, let's build a couple chairs. Let's build a configuration. Let's put it out there. Because, you know, for what I do know as a designer, I'm always surprised what I don't know or what I will be surprised what somebody will do. So I think, if you have the time in there in the budget or at least the time, test driving a couple things in the actual environment is a great way to go. I think when people do that, they get much better results.
Very good. Well, this has been very enlightening, and there's a lot of good information. And as a reminder, if you know somebody who you think would be interested in today's webinar, it will be available starting tomorrow on airportimprovement.com under the webinar tab. And as I mentioned, all these questions and the questions that were asked but we didn't have time to get to, we will get back to you individually to answer your questions. I'd like to thank you, Joe and Matt, for your presentation. I'd like to thank everybody who's listening for spending a part of your day with us. And this now concludes the webinar, Airport Interiors, What You Need to Know. Thank you, Joe. Thank you, Matt.
All right. Thanks very much. Take care.
Okay.